One morning, a couple months ago, excuse me, sang too much this morning. Don't make me do that. One morning, a couple months ago, I received an email from someone in our congregation. The subject line read, sermon topic / Bible study suggestion. And this is what she wrote. I find myself in a struggle. I know that hating the hater isn't going to help anything, but I'm so disappointed in mankind right now. Love thy neighbor and turn the other cheek aren't cutting it for me right now. I can't even look or listen to the president. I've prayed. I've talked. I've listened. I feel like God is sad. And I can't seem to find a direction to go or the peace to stay. That need not sound so dire. Just my little brain trying to figure out how to help and positively channel my energies. I appreciate the sincerity of that question and believe that it deserves a thoughtful answer. Let me be quick to affirm that here at Life Journey Church, we don't all think alike about politics or most anything. We are a church that celebrates that this is a place where we don't demand groupthink. Some of us are probably in a place where we're comfortable with the current political direction of our nation, but many of us are not and are struggling to figure out how to respond in a way that is consistent with our faith and values. Regardless what your politics are, there will no doubt come a time, if not now, then sometime in the future, when you find yourself saying, Lord, what am I supposed to do with this? So, let's tackle that question today. Before we dive into such a deadly serious question, though, let me share, if you will permit, a little bit of bipartisan humor just to relax our spirits, because laughter is good for the soul, right? You know what the Bible says? Proverbs 17:22, a merry heart does good like a medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. Countless scientific studies have shown that one of the best medicines for heart, body, and mind is just to simply relax and laugh sometime. That's why I try to build some humor into my sermons. It's not because I think I'm Jerry Seinfeld. It's not because I think I need to entertain you. It's because, you know, life has wounded a lot of us. A lot of us have been wounded by the churches or religious experiences of our past. I want this to be a place of healing, a place of joy and peace. So, in that spirit, did you hear about the time Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer both ended up on the same small plane headed to a political conference? In mid-flight, they got into this really big debate about whose ideas would bless and benefit the most people. At one point, McConnell pulls a $100 bill out of his pocket, holds it up, and says, I could throw this $100 bill out the window of this plane and make somebody down below very happy. To that, Schumer responds, Mitch, that's the difference between you and me, because if that were my $100 bill, I'd break it into 10 tens, throw all 10 out the window, and make 10 people down below very happy. Not to be outdone, McConnell says, well, I could take this $100 bill and break it into 100 $1 bills, drop it out the window, and bless 100 people down below. Back and forth they went until finally the pilot has had all that he can stand, turned around and said, gentlemen, I could throw both of you out this window and make 325 people, million people down below very happy. So take a deep breath. Feel the medicine rushing to your soul. And now hopefully we're ready to tackle a deadly serious subject. Let's start with prayer. God, we live in a world with a lot of hardship. There are a lot of grave challenges that our nation faces. We worry a lot. We feel fear, anxiety, outrage, sadness, helplessness, frustration. What should we do? Source of all light and life, show us the way. We ask in the name of Jesus. Amen. I have always found today's Bible story to be strange. It's a story, at least at first blush, of people coming together to work in harmony for a common purpose, to create progress, but then God intervenes, breaks them apart into different languages and nations, and progress comes to a screeching halt. Why? Why would God do that? Is God against progress? But then, in recent weeks, as I've been meditating on this story in preparation for today's sermon, I have come to see it in a very different way. Remember, we're in the midst of a sermon series where we've first moved through the Genesis creation story, and then we came to the story of the fall of humanity. And now we're looking at certain short stories early in the book of Genesis that are meant to illustrate how the fall of humanity has impacted everything that is around us. It occurred to me as I've been meditating on this story in recent weeks, that Genesis chapter 11 is meant to illustrate for us how our human brokenness affects culture and politics. How so? Take a look. Genesis 11:1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And they said to one another, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. That is our first big clue as to what's happening in this story. It is fascinating to me that when the powers that be, the political powers that be in Babel at the time, saw an opportunity to rally all the people to unite behind a common cause, they did not say, hey, let's feed the hungry, heal the sick, and house the homeless. Instead, they said, they seized this opportunity to rally all the people to unite them behind the common purpose of building a great city, and in particular, this huge tower that would be a monument forever testifying to the greatness of those political leaders of Babel. It seems that the political powers that be in Babel at the time were far more interested in empire building than meeting the needs of the common people. So you get the picture right here. These leaders are seizing the opportunity to rally all of the people behind projects that were going to exalt their own greatness, their own reputations in history. And whenever you get into a situation like that, whether it's now or way back when, you are in a dangerous situation. And so, verse 5 tells us the Lord God came down to see the city and the tower which the mortals had built. The Lord said, look, they are one people, and they have all one language. And key phrase, this is only the beginning of what they will do. How the tone you put in that phrase determines how you interpret this passage. Does it say, this is only the beginning of what they will do? Or does it say, this is only the beginning of what they will do? Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. So let's go down and confuse their language so that they will not understand one another's speech. So God scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Do you see what's happening here? When people unite together for a common purpose, nothing is impossible for them. United people, led by good leaders, can accomplish incredibly wonderful things, but there's another side to that coin. United people, led by bad leaders, can do horrific things. things in this world. Imagine if in the 1940s, all of the people of the earth had united behind the political leadership of Adolf Hitler. Thank God there were people with other languages, people in other nations who were able to rise up and resist the Nazi movement, or we today would be living in a horrific and dystopian world. And what was true in the 1940s is equally true way back in the beginning. God seemed to sense that for Earth to survive and have a chance at thriving, it was necessary to have a system of checks and balances so that no one nation would ever be able to gain enough power that if that nation went bad, it could bring the whole Earth down with it. Because you see, a broken world fuels broken politics. And what was true way back then is equally true in our world today. Evan Williams was so excited when the company he had co-founded launched Twitter. Twitter was going to create a platform that would enable all of humanity to have one big conversation. The sky was the limit. The modern technological version of the Tower of Babel. Let us build a tower that reaches to the heaven. Twitter was going to make possible the kind of communication that we once thought only possible for divinity. Everybody, anybody on the face of the earth could engage in sharing information and have a common conversation. And Evan Williams and others were so excited about the potential of this. In fact, a recent New York Times article points out that all of the great founders of internet platforms have all been fueled by that deep sense of optimism that enabling human communication and contact was going to definitely make for progress, make things better. But this same New York Times article goes on to point out that on Facebook it's now possible to live stream suicides, beatings, and murders in real time. Twitter has become a hive of trollers and abuse that it cannot seem to control. And fake news is everywhere, threatening to undermine the very foundations of democracy, the very foundations of good government. And the New York Times article went on to say that 4 out of 10 adults report as adults having been abused or harassed online. All of which has caused Evan Williams, the co-founder of Twitter, to step back and say, quote, "I once thought that when everybody could speak freely and exchange information and ideas, the world would automatically be a better place. I was wrong about that. I think the internet is broken." And here we go again. The story of the Tower of Babel replicating itself in its own unique way in our own time. It seems that whenever we human beings pull together and think we are about to work together on a common cause to make everything better, our brokenness can easily hijack everything. We live in a broken world that fuels broken politics. Recently, as I've been driving about, I've been listening on our satellite radio to one of those throwback 1960s stations, reminding myself of all of the songs I used to love when I was a kid. And a couple weeks ago, I was reminded of one of my all-time 60s favorites, The Age of Aquarius. You know the song, right? When the moon is in the seventh house and Jupiter aligns with Mars, then peace will guide our planet, and love will steer the stars. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, the age of Aquarius, Aquarius! Woo! I love that song! Isn't that one of the best songs ever written? I don't know. I don't know exactly where we are in history right now. But I do know that we're not in the age of Aquarius. So how should we as people of faith respond to broken politics in our time? Fortunately for us, we're not the first generation of people of faith to face such issues. As you look through the Bible repeatedly, you see biblical stories and biblical eras where people of faith were struggling with exactly the same questions. And as I've looked back through those key stories, it has dawned on me that there are at least three key themes that are echoed in each of these situations, three key things that people of faith throughout the ages have done to respond to political upheaval in their time. The first of these things you're not going to want to hear, but it's critically important. It begins with, number one, hopeful endurance. Consciously choosing to cultivate an attitude of hopeful endurance. James, the brother of Jesus, put it this way, James 1:2. Whenever you face trials of any kind, consider it nothing but joy, because you know that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its full effect, so that you may be mature and complete, lacking in nothing. The implication of these words is that an attitude of hopeful endurance is the pinnacle of spiritual maturity and completeness. In other words, you will know that you are a spiritually powerful person when you get to that place where you are customarily responding to great challenges and trials and tribulations in your life with an attitude of hopeful endurance. Our ancestors in the faith faced the kinds of political challenges that we can only imagine in our worst dreams. For example, in AD 64, the early Christians faced a huge outbreak of persecution under Roman Emperor Nero. Nero apparently was interested in recreating Rome in his own image, his own Tower of Babel experience. And so rumor has it he caused a fire to be lit in Rome that ended up burning out of control and destroyed a large part of Rome, so that now he could rebuild it in his image. But when rumor began to spread that Nero is the one who may have done that, he needed to cover for himself. So he started a rumor that it was the Christians who had done it. At the time, Christians were a despised and misunderstood minority. And so Nero began rounding up thousands of Christians. The Roman historian Tacitus describes what happened this way. Tacitus says, quote, "An immense multitude of Christians was convicted. Besides being put to death, they were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were clothed in the hides of beasts so that dogs would tear them to death. Others were crucified. Others were set on fire to serve to illuminate the night when the daylight failed." Can you imagine such an evil political regime? How did our ancestors in the faith not just get through that, but triumph over it? The book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, tells us how. If you were here several months ago when Alex Pittaway preached a sermon on the book of Revelation, you know that in the book of Revelation, John describes this terrible, evil ruler that creates all kinds of destruction. But he never names that ruler, because to have named that ruler would have put he, John, and his readers in danger of even greater persecution. So instead, John needed to find a coded way of referring to this evil ruler that his readers would recognize, but that the Roman authorities would probably not get. And so it appears, theologians tell us, it appears that John picked a coded number that his readers, familiar with the Hebrew language, would be able to put together, but that the Roman authorities would be unlikely to do so. So we get the famous verse, Revelation 13:18. After John describes this great beastly leader, he then goes on to say what the identity of that beastly leader is. "This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person. Its number is 666. Throughout the ages, people have puzzled, what does that mean? One of the leading theories is that this was a reference to Caesar Nero. You see, the name Caesar Nero, spelled in Hebrew, would have looked like line 2 that you see up here. Q-S-R-N-R-W-N. In ancient Hebrew, vowels were omitted. They were implied. And John's readers, but probably not the Roman authorities, would have been familiar that in the Hebrew alphabet, numbers were associated with certain letters. And the particular numbers associated with Q, S, R, N, R, W, N, Caesar, Nero, when you add them together, happen to total 666, leading many theologians to conclude that the primary meaning of the ruler that John was talking about in Revelation was Caesar Nero. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. When it comes to biblical prophecy, there are often multiple levels of meaning. By that I mean, often in biblical prophecy, there is a meaning that was primary to the time, the people who were being written to at the time, and secondary meanings for the future. So my point is not that this concept of 666 has no future application. My point is, to the immediate readers of John's book of Revelation, the primary meaning for them in their time was probably that this was a reference to Caesar Nero. And I tell you all of that because of how John advises these early Christians to cope with Caesar Nero. He goes on, after encoded language identifying this evil ruler, he goes on to tell those early Christians what they needed to do, how they needed to think about this. In the very next verse, he starts to describe a beautiful vision of an exalted worship session in heaven, exalting the greatness of God. And then he goes on to tell these early Christians that the goodness and the greatness of God was bound to eventually overcome not just Caesar Nero, but the whole Roman Empire. It was going to come tumbling down. And then John wraps it all up with this exhortation in Revelation 14:12. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints. Hopeful endurance. The sure confidence that if they remained faithful, Caesar Nero was going to bite the dust and goodness was going to prevail. That is what gave these early Christians what they needed to push through horrific political circumstances. What worked for these early Christians under dire circumstances, we can only imagine, will work with equal measure in the lesser challenges and circumstances that we find ourselves in our world today. You see, grim endurance is not helpful at all. It only causes defeat and despair. Hopeful endurance is what transforms that experience of endurance into something that gives power and fuels energy. It's the power of hope. There's an insightful scene in the movie Hunger Games. You're no doubt familiar with the plot of the movie Hunger Games, right? President Snow is the ruler over this evil futuristic nation called Pan Am that has risen out of the ashes of the destruction of the United States. And in Pan Am, each year they hold the Hunger Games, whereby they compel each of the 12 districts to select by lottery two teenagers, one boy and one girl, to send to participate in the nationally televised Hunger Games. These teenagers being forced to fight to the death until there was one survivor who was declared the winner. There's an insightful scene in the movie where President Snow is talking to his chief game maker, Seneca, and asking him why it's important that they have a winner in the Hunger Games. After all, if the purpose of these Hunger Games was simply to intimidate the districts, which is what the purpose was, by showing them who's boss, by saying we can grab your teenagers and put them in dangerous situations and kill them and you can't stop it. If the purpose was simply intimidation, why not simply force all the districts to select two teenagers by lottery, send them in, and then just execute them to show everybody who's boss? Why did there have to be a winner? Watch this conversation between President Snow and Seneca.
Seneca, why do you think we have a winner?
What do you mean?
I mean, why do we have a winner? Hope.
Hope?
is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective. A lot of hope is dangerous. A spark is fine, as long as it's contained.
So,
contain it.
Did you catch that? What he says there? He says, hope is the only thing stronger than fear. A little hope is effective, but a lot of hope is dangerous. So contain it, Seneca. You see, a little bit of hope is effective even for a tyrannical government because it tends to pacify people and make them less likely to resist. But a lot of hope is positively dangerous to tyrannical governments because people who have hope fight back. People who have a lot of hope keep on keeping on. People who have a lot of hope will dare to attempt great things in opposition to evil in the world, which is exactly what the early Christians were inspired to do and exactly why they were able to prevail. I'm here today to remind us that there is nothing quite so subversive as the power of hope. So never let anyone drain or contain your hope. Hope is a choice. We choose to have hope because, like our ancestors in the faith, we believe that God's goodness is greater than present tribulation, and that that goodness, if we remain faithful, is bound to triumph and overcome, even if we can't see how it's going to happen. So tell me, are you consciously cultivating that attitude of hopeful endurance in your life? By the way, this will work not just in situations of political tribulation, but in any situation of tribulation in life. We have to cultivate hopeful endurance. It is the hallmark of spiritual maturity. It is the key to being a spiritually powerful person. And once we have that down, hopeful endurance, we're then ready to take step number two. How does faith respond to political upheaval? Number one, hopeful endurance, which then inevitably leads us to number two, patient prophetic action. In both the Old Testament and in the New Testament, whenever people of faith are embracing enduring hope, they are inevitably then inspired to keep on doing whatever they can, little things here and there, to move them closer and closer to their deliverance. One simple act at a time, patiently, painstakingly, joyfully. So when we find ourselves in situations of great political upheaval, remember, do, don't stew. Next time you're watching the TV and you're stewing, remember, don't stew, do. Little actions one by one that over time accumulate and build momentum. You're probably familiar that Jackie Robinson was the first African-American to break the color barrier in Major League Baseball decades ago. His very presence in Major League Baseball was a courageous, prophetic act, and it wasn't easy. For example, in one game in his home stadium in Brooklyn, Robinson made an error. He let a ball get past him that he shouldn't have. And immediately, his own hometown fans started to boo and catcall with such an intensity, not the kind of grumbling that you might expect when one of your hometown players makes an error, but the intensity of the booing and the catcalls were so great, it was apparent that the folks in the stands were giving vent to their latent pent-up racism. This was an excuse for them to get all over this guy that they thought shouldn't be on their team. The boos, the catcalls were humiliating as he's standing there in the middle of this stadium of thousands of people. That's when one of his teammates, Pee-wee Reese, walked over to Jackie Robinson, put his arm around his shoulder, and glared at the fans in the stands as if to say, I'm with him. If you're against him, you're against me. We stand together. And they got it. Immediately there was quiet in the stadium. Later, Jackie Robinson would say, that is the act that saved his career. As people of faith, when we see something that's wrong, when we see an injustice that's being done, we don't look the other way and say, oh, what a shame, what's the world coming to? No, we are called to do what we can, to take a stand, to stand with. Dr. Ismar Shorshish, former chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, back in 1994, had the opportunity to travel back to his grandfather's ancestral village in Germany, the village called Esslingen. In that small village, back in the 1940s, Shorsch's grandfather had been the headmaster of a Jewish school connected to a synagogue. But in the midst of the Nazi hysteria of the time, one night a mob arose in Esslingen and burned down the school and the associated synagogue. Now, 50 years later, on the 50th anniversary of that atrocity, Shorshish was being invited to come back and help memorialize the courage and what his grandfather had stood for. When Shorshish was back in Esslingen looking around, they took him on a tour of an historical museum-like display commemorating what had happened 50 years earlier. Shorshish says, the most haunting thing I saw was a brief black and white film clip that somebody had shot the day after the tragedy, as people from Esslingen were filing past the ruins of that school and synagogue. He says there were, quote, his words, there was no trace of agitation, no dismay on their faces. They could just as easily have been going to church or to the theater. The calamity that had befallen their neighbors evoked neither anger nor protest. He goes on to say, to carry out the final solution, the Nazi needed the willful non-involvement of untold numbers of bystanders. Oh, look at that. They burned down the school and the synagogue. Isn't that interesting? What's the world coming to? What a shame. The Bible condemns that kind of indifference. Deuteronomy 22:3, you must not remain indifferent. Let those words settle in. You must not remain indifferent. If you see your neighbor's donkey or ox fallen on the road, do not ignore it. You must help him raise it. That's what God says. Do what you can. Don't stand back and say, well, it's not happening to, quote, my people. We're all in this together. We stand together, arm in arm. When we see injustice, we are called to respond. When our brother or sister faces calamity, we are called to stand with them rather than looking the other way. The Bible condemns indifference. It's when sometimes the problems that face our society can be so overwhelming that we're tempted to throw up our hands and say, oh, what's the use? There's no point in it. When enough people do that, evil prevails. But when enough people push back and do what they can, evil starts to fail. Every Monday morning on my day off, as I drive my dog out to the woods to go for a run, as we're headed east on Prospect Street, I see a young woman who looks to be about 30 years old out along the country roadway picking up trash. It's not in front of her house. It's an uninhabited portion of the roadway that apparently she has felt called to adopt as her personal statement against global pollution. I remember when I first drove past her thinking, good luck, because the trash she picks up today will be replaced by more trash the next week as people drive by. But every week when I drive by her and she's patiently picking up this trash, I find myself thinking, she has a prophetic call, and she is defiantly doing what she can. It may seem like a drop of water in the ocean, but it's what she can do. And she knows when enough people do the same thing, then finally the evil of pollution will begin to be contained and beaten back. And I find myself admiring her spirit and saying, I want to be more like that. All God asks us to do in times of great challenge is what we can do. What can we do in a time of political upheaval? For starters, there's an election coming up on November 6th, and we can cast our ballots. Every single person in this church has a sacred responsibility not to be indifferent, to care enough to go out and vote the way that God calls you to vote. Are you registered to vote? If not, in the weeks ahead, we'll have people out in the social hall who can register you to vote. Do you say, I don't vote because I don't have a ride to the polls? In the weeks ahead of the election, we'll share with you a link where you can go and get a free ride to the polls. Every single one of us ought to be voting. It's sinful not to use the opportunity that God gives us to vote. On top of that, we have the opportunity to contribute to and support campaigns and causes that we feel called to. We have the opportunity when we see our neighbor, when we see a wrong and injustice being done to our neighbor, we have the opportunity to stand with that neighbor and put our arm around the shoulder and say, we're together. If you're against my neighbor, you are against me. We have the opportunity when we as a church come together like we did with the Immigrant Welcome Center a few months ago. So many of us rallied together to minister to the needs of the Congolese refugees fleeing civil war in their country. We have the opportunity coming up in October as we launch a major project with the Dayspring Center for the Homeless, helping them do critical renovation of their facility. We'll have an opportunity to present in that. All God asks us to do is what we can do. God doesn't ask us to solve the problem, all of the problem, but if enough people like us do what we can do, that's when change happens. Do, don't stew. So, how do we respond to political upheaval in the world, in our nation? One, hopeful endurance. Two, patient prophetic action. And before we close, one more that I've got to mention that we won't want to hear either, but is so critically important: transformational kindness. Jesus said, love your enemies, Matthew 5:44. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, hate cannot overcome hate, only love can do that. In times of great political tribulation, we want to fight fire with fire. We face that temptation all the time to meet name-calling with more name-calling, but then we only become co-opted by the hate that we're seeking to eliminate. There must be a better way. True story. About 10 years ago, Bruce Holt was driving into Washington, D.C. in the midst of crazy, busy rush hour traffic, the kind of traffic that just makes you crazy. As he's driving along, bumper to bumper, start and stop, he watches as a young woman in an economy-sized car whips off a side street into the flow of traffic, forcing the driver of the vehicle a couple cars ahead of him to smash on his brakes to avoid hitting her. Then they get trapped at the stoplight, and Bruce watches as the man in that vehicle that had come to a screeching halt jumps out of it, filled with rage, starts striding toward the economy car of the woman who pulled out in front of him. She pops out of her car, rushes back to him with a big smile on her face, throws her arms around him, gives him a hug, then kisses him on the lips, gets back in her economy vehicle. By now the light has changed, and she darts off, leaving him standing there, no longer angry, but completely dumbfounded and disarmed. Now, the next time you cut somebody off in traffic, I do not recommend that strategy. It could backfire. But, it is a powerful reminder that unexpected kindness can disarm anger and hate. Jesus did not say, love your enemy, because he wanted us to be weak. Precisely the opposite. Jesus said, love your enemy, because he knows that love is the only power known to humanity that can actually destroy hate, that can build bridges to those that oppose us. Let me close with this. I had an opportunity a couple of weeks ago to watch the docudrama that's circulating now called The Notorious RBG. Have you seen it? It tells the life story of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It tells how back in 1959, when she graduated at the top of her class at Columbia Law School, not one law firm in New York City would hire her because she was a woman. But she had hopeful endurance, kept pushing forward, became a law school professor, and then ultimately litigated civil rights cases, in particular women's rights cases for the ACLU, ended up arguing some of the most landmark women's rights cases before the Supreme Court and winning those cases, and then ultimately in the 1990s was appointed to the Supreme Court as a justice, and since has been able to write key opinions on women's rights and other key civil rights issues. But here's one of the most interesting twists in the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. During her tenure on the court, before he passed away, she became best of friends with her polar opposite conservative nemesis on the court, Antonin Scalia. I mean, they were at each other's throats on most every issue in the courtroom, but outside the courtroom, they became famous friends. Here's a picture of them together at enjoying the opera. Here's a picture of them traveling through India together. In fact, at one point, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was asked why she, as a feminist, rode behind Scalia on this elephant with a twinkle in her eye. She said it was simply a matter of proper weight distribution. In the documentary, she is asked, doesn't it feel odd, maybe even a little treasonous, to be such good friends with such a dyed-in-the-wool political opponent? Her response was, before my mother died when I was a teenager, she always gave me the same advice over and over again. She said two things. She said, Ruth, always be a lady and always be independent. By independent, she meant always be in a position to stand on your own two feet. By be a lady, she explained, she meant the same thing that we would mean if we said to our son, always be a gentleman. In other words, always treat the people around you with unfailing civility, respect, and kindness. She went on to explain that one of the most powerful ways we can create change is to build bridges of friendship to our political opponents. Ruth Bader Ginsburg did not form that friendship with Scalia out of weakness, but just the opposite, out of strength. It was Abraham Lincoln who said, do I not destroy my enemy when I make him my friend? That's what Dr. King did. That's what Mandela did. That's what Gandhi did. That's what Lincoln did. That's what Ginsburg did. And most importantly, that's what Jesus Christ did. And all of those I just named, they won. They ultimately prevailed. This is the time-tested biblical formula for creating change in a broken world. It is hopeful endurance coupled with patient prophetic action wrapped in transformational kindness. Do this, and goodness will ultimately prevail. Thanks be to God.